This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name is Chris Scott and I'm here with Wilco Lamb. How are you, Wilco?
Very good, thank you, Chris.
You are a Dutch winemaker here in Martinborough. You're the chairman of the local wine growers association, but you've got your own wine, Oroterra.
Correct, yes.
How long have you been running Oroterra? It's you and some other people, isn't it?
Yeah, so we got the opportunity to pitch a vineyard here and start the brand in 2022. And we moved on to the property in September. So together with a team that I've been working with for a long time prior and an investor, we decided to start fresh and come with a completely new project that hopefully I will retire with at some point.
You brought a lot of your Dry River team with you when Dry River got sold off.
Yeah, Dry River was in the process of being sold and we decided that it was time for a new project and the whole team was interested in coming with me on this project. So we jumped the ship and came here.
And when you purchased Oroterra, it was already an established vineyard. So you were producing wines from day one as opposed to that first 3+ years of waiting around.
Correct, yeah, we moved in here. This was a vineyard that was established in the mid 80s and close to our heart really in terms of our practices. So it was already being farmed organically, dry farmed as well. So we were able to continue those practices really easily with a team that was very experienced in this type of wine growing, wine production. And that meant that our first vintage happened straight away in 2023 without the wait for planting a vineyard, young vines. We had mature vines from day one.
How many hectares have you got?
A total now of just over 10 hectares planted.
Yes, yeah, so it's still quite small though, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think it is probably the right way to just think of it now as establishment phase on the Martinborough Terrace, and if there's any opportunities in the future, maybe outside of Martinborough, we'll jump on that for sure. But this is a good size, I think, to establish ourselves, our name, distribution, because that's definitely one of the harder ones to rely on or you know, to build a brand around.
Last week you said that Poplar did really well by starting out with a cellar door. You really haven't got a cellar door here, you know what I mean? It's all by invite only if you want to come and taste your wines. So you're not even following your own advice, really.
No, that's right. Absolutely. I think starting a wine business, especially these days in such a crowded market, with lots of amazing producers in the market, having a sales outlet or a readily available network or ability to sell wine, I think that's where you start looking before really investing heavily in vineyards and expensive winery equipment. The sales facilities is critical.
Let's talk about distribution. We're going to talk a wee bit about your organic and regenerative practices later on in the podcast. But you're selling your wines overseas. So you've gone from 2022, you've got distribution in Japan, China, Spain, which is a bit unusual, Oz, and then within New Zealand as well. No UK distribution. Is that a deliberate choice or you haven't found the right partner? What's going on there?
No, well, so just talking about sort of our sales outlet and going against my own advice, we were quite lucky to have a network of distribution that I had with, you know, previously with people who were really interested to follow our project and to jump on board. So quite quickly we have our market established, or not a whole market, but we had markets there that were going to take our wine. The UK, yeah, obviously that's would be crown on the ability to sell, you know, in a fantastic market. There is definitely an interest, but I think the UK market also is a lot harder. They're far more critical, I think. Not far more critical, than I sort of don't do justice to the other countries or other distributors, but it's definitely a harder market to penetrate, I think. The interest in New Zealand wine is there. We have interested parties, but I think they are just sort of seeing there's no rush here. They would, in the past, take vintages that are 2, 3, 4 years old anyway. So I'm not overly worried that we won't find the right partner in the UK. Some things just need to take time.
Yeah, okay. And what about Nordic markets? Have you thought about that?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Nordic markets for us have always been quite tricky, and that's more because of sales volume that we've never been able to supply enough for the Nordic markets. Amazing restaurant scene, which I think is the most important method of selling in the Nordic markets. And again, that will come as part of brand building and market building over the next few years. We've only released one wine so far. The second one is around the corner. So there's plenty of time.
I mean, you've only got 10 hectares, so you're not producing a lot of wine. Tell me about your sales in Japan and China and Spain. Are they going down the restaurant? I presume they're going down the restaurant channel.
Yes, most of it is, and that's, I think, majority is just really price point. Spain, amazing partner. We've been with Medis, Grupo Medis, previously, and they actually just visited us the other week here. They are probably the specialists in Portugal, Andorra, and Spain for New Zealand wine, and have for 20 years now put lots of energy in that category. But also China distributor, he's New Zealand Chinese, in an amazing established relationship with them too, and they're happy to invest in a new project, in a new brand, because we've got to recognize too that they got to have that faith that we come to the market in the next so many years with wines that will fulfill their expectations. Japan is quite new for us. I never really had much to do with Japan in previous jobs, but here we found an amazing partner that actually visited us really early on when we just bought the vineyard. They kept in touch. They were sort of on the front line with us and probably the first partner that we sold our wines to as well. So really happy to be represented in Japan. I'd love to explore that market by visiting them and see what that means, mm-hmm. selling wine in Japan. Australia, all partners. So again, what I think is wine is a community. Wine is a community of relationships that have lasted for me for a long time. And those relationships are really built on if our partner is in trouble, we'll support them. If we're doing it tough, they'll support us. It really is an extension of the business, whether that is in Spain, the US, in Australia. Our distribution partners are really our sales partners and hugely important.
In New Zealand, you're being distributed by Blanc.
Yeah.
Who are they and what do they do and where do they target your wines?
Yeah, Blanc was founded by Angie Atkinson. So she used to be, I'm pretty sure, the sales manager for Prophet's Rock in Central Otago before she decided to move back to Auckland and start her own distribution and a company called Blanc. She's got two other people working with her, but she's a real driving force in and has been in the last 5 years in Auckland, a tireless, amazing woman who goes around, who is definitely the face of her own business. And on giant shoulders, the little company that was in charge of this vineyard was associated with her. And I thought, well, distribution is really, really important. I didn't know Angie, but really quickly, she was quite enthusiastic for our project to get off the ground and to support us. So we just thought that was amazing. And I think we've built up quite a nice relationship with her in the last year and a half.
Okay. One of the things about your vineyards are that you're organic and you're moving towards biodynamic, is that
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
But you also claim to be regenerative, and some of the traditional organic and biodynamic processes aren't regenerative, you know, the idea of cover crops and then turning them over and ploughing between rows and things like that are clearly not regenerative practices. So I'm interested to know about the organic and biodynamic processes that aren't regenerative that you've had to replace or change to become more regenerative.
Correct. I think just claiming to be either organic or biodynamic isn't enough. It clearly isn't. I think the philosophies and the ideas are absolutely admirable, and I think it is something that people should expect from high-quality producers, that they do think about their use of pesticides and chemistry in vineyards and the way they treat their land. And sort of claiming regenerative farming, is, that still is quite loose as well. I think there is no real golden bullet for regenerative farming. I think it is the best next aid for those who practice, whether you are organic or not, to actually think about your diesel use, your compaction rates, the loss of carbon in the soil, or the addition of carbon to the soil, and really make soil as part of your farming ideas. Mm. You can't ignore soil as a living entity, really.
Because organics and biodynamics is all about the soil's health, but it never used to worry about the carbon levels in the soil, and they were losing carbon with some of those practices.
Yes, mowing strategies or cover crop strategies, direct drilling, how to use cover crop correctly in terms of the nutrients and the carbon it will bring into the soil. With vineyards, it's slightly more tricky because when cover crops, say, grow and we'd like to lay them down to seed back into, quite often that happens when we are ripening fruit. So we have to think about humidity levels, or maybe early in the spring, but frost risk. At the moment, we've got bird protection nets over our vineyards. We can't actually go in with a tractor, even if we do want to lay down a cover crop to sow into for a winter crop. It physically isn't possible. So for us, thinking about regenerative farming is obviously then has to be catered towards the restrictions that we have itself in a vineyard on timings. And I think that is the next challenge for wine growers is how do we fit our annual cycles in with new farming ideas and farming practices to celebrate biology and to celebrate a living entity and have vines growing happily, digging down, mining the soils. The regenerative farming ideas help drive roots down, and I think that's the main idea.
What have you done? So,
well, the main thing really is thinking about tractor passes. We can't just keep going through like, oh, there's weeds growing, let's just send the tractor through and undervine weed. Like, we have to be more strategic about that in the first place. We have to think about the type of cover crops we're growing, so what type of rooting depths they have, what type of nutrients they bring back in, how resilient they are to our climate in terms of wind and drought, how can we extend their lifespans. So I think it's not, you know, we can't just now think, oh yeah, there's beans going in. Let's think about cover crops that suit us and that we only have to go in once every fourth row and get cycles going rather than the whole vineyard. So I think it's planning for us and responding to the season itself too.
It's interesting you talk about tractor hours. Mm. There's always a famous quote from Caleb, who is, there's a show called Clarkson's Farm in the UK, and one of the guys called Caleb, and he goes on about every time a tractor's running, that's money.
Yes.
But you mentioned diesel. So from a regenerative point of view, are you worried? Is it the diesel that you're worried about, or the soil compaction, or both?
Both, yeah, absolutely.
So one of the issues you've got is a lot of the technologies used to replace pesticides and herbicides and fungicides are things like mechanical weeding or UV light. They're all less efficient than herbicides and fungicides and pesticides in terms of how long they last. And you have to go back and you have to massively increase the amount of tractor time to move away from these diseases.
Yeah.
So it's, how is that, do you understand the complexities there and what the trade-offs are?
Like in the end, I think the trade-off is how we farm our vines. So changes in types of pruning, crop loads, amount of shoots per hectare. If we can reduce disease pressure levels in the vineyard and increase openness, not so much by leaf plucking and opening, but more early on, all the work that I think we do early, so in the winter, set the amount of targeted yield by shoot numbers, then come in and remove any excess shoots and keep canopies open. think about a cover crops that might increase the amount of humidity or reduce the amount of airflow, we have to think about those. So it's farming itself, not just thinking about, oh, there's a tractor going, that's diesel, that's compaction. There's a lot more to it, really. Maybe just invest a little bit more in people.
In the UK, or not just in the UK, but in Europe, there's been a resurgence in looking at what they call peewee grape varieties, which are a new wave of hybrids. And, you know, the old days where hybrids were very, they had an interesting aroma profile to them, that they've selected and selected and selected now to the point where you're getting the disease resistance of the hybrid, but you're getting the Vitis vinifera flavor profiles coming through. Have you guys looked at that, or are you aware of anybody who's looking at those type of new varieties?
Absolutely. We've got a nursery in New Zealand that focuses on that.
Who's that?
Riverside Nursery. One of the main drivers for that, Jim White here at Cloudy Bay, he is a real advocate of looking at Vitis vinifera alternatives. The biggest problem, New Zealand being an island in the bottom of the ocean, they're quite careful with what comes into the country in terms of plant material. So that has to go through all sorts of quarantine practices and requirements. So everything takes a little bit longer here for the selection of varieties to come into the country and then see if that's suitable. Definitely eyes on those developments that are happening really rapidly in Europe here too.
What was the name of the nursery?
Riversun Nursery.
And where are they?
They're actually based in Gisborne.
Missed them.
But Jim White at Cloudy Bay, he'll be a really good person to talk.
All right. We tasted your wines. You have got a Chardonnay, a Pinot Gris, and a Pinot Noir, and they've all had 100% new oak, but the wines didn't really come across as overtly oaky. There was, you know, most of them I went oak and put a question mark on it, which for new oak is quite unusual. And then you said, look, they're fudras or really big barrels. Tell me a bit about your barrel selection and what you're doing and why.
Yeah, well, initially starting out completely new, I wasn't keen to buy secondhand barrels from other people. The challenge was bringing new barrels in without then everything being overly oaked. So the idea was just to bring in large format barrels or fooders to reduce the impact of new oak, yet have wine sitting in oak. So the 23 that you just tasted was then obviously from that first year. That was sort of the big challenge, is how do we overcome the impact of new oak. We did that with large formats. We're really happy how the wines have responded to that and are continuing our journey in that. So all our wine now lies mostly in large format for 500 liter to 2000 liter formats. That doesn't mean that they're all new, you know, obviously they're very expensive and we got to respect that oak, but there's a certain amount of oak that will keep coming through that we are purchasing every year, but that is not the big whack in straight away in the first year. So now that's more a maintenance program. For me, the slower evolution in barrel, the lower pickup of oxygen means we can keep the wine in barrel for longer. We can reduce our sulfur levels. We can sulfur a lot later. And I think that has really benefited the evolution of the wines in the vessels. It retains freshness. It can lie on lees for a lot longer. So a beautiful soft structure and support from that lees impact, I think, also means that we're slowly sort of moving away from overtly varietal characters. I'd like to think that our wines are not overtly Pinot Gris or overtly Chardonnay, but that it sort of moves away from that archetype a little bit, purely by extending maturation levels, lower sulfur use.
And are you buying new big barrels, or are you bringing some smaller barrels in now that you've got some older barrels that aren't really imparting a lot of oak texture to the wines, oak flavour to the wines? Are you now bringing in more classical barriques into the blend?
Haven't yet. Actually, 26, the coming vintage, we'll have our first two brand new barriques, but that's purely just to sort of see what the impact will be. At the moment, I'm still convinced that this purity and this really low impact of the larger formats is sort of the direction I'd like to go in. The oak impact for me is not important. It is the inherent sort of quality of our fruit that I'd like to have as the carriers of the wine.
Okay then, I think we'll wrap it up there, Wilco. Thank you very much. Cheers very much, bud.
Pleasure.